On election night 2016, even Trump's own campaign manager was already reaching out to television producers about post-election work. The candidate himself had spent months telling his wife Melania there was no way he would win, a promise that seemed absolutely certain until the electoral votes started rolling in. This wasn't false modesty. The Trump campaign had accidentally replicated the producers, creating a show designed to fail but somehow succeeding spectacularly. When victory became inevitable, witnesses watched Trump's expression morph from befuddled to disbelieving to horrified in rapid succession. He had wanted to become the most famous man in the world and was already planning a Trump television network. The presidency? That was never actually the plan. Yet here we are, watching what happens when a reality TV star who never expected to govern suddenly has to figure out how to run the most powerful nation on Earth. Trump Tower became command central for the most chaotic presidential transition in modern history. Trump forced cabinet candidates and world leaders to endure what staffers called the perp walk past cameras and gawkers. This spectacle masked a terrifying reality. Almost nobody in Trump's inner circle had relevant political experience. While previous presidents-elect tapped networks of policy experts, Trump offered important jobs on the spot to people he'd just met. The chief of staff search revealed the dysfunction. Trump first approached billionaire friend Tom Barrack, hoping an organizational whiz could handle boring tasks. When Barrack declined, Trump considered son-in-law Jared, until Ann Coulter bluntly told him, "You can't hire your children." He settled on RXC chairman Reince Priebus, though he structured the role to ensure Priebus would be the unimportant one. Trump was already rewriting history, transforming himself into the inevitable president. When Silicon Valley executives visited, Trump boasted to Rupert Murdoch about helping them with visas. After hanging up, Murdoch muttered, "What a fucking idiot," a preview of what was to come. Steve Bannon arrived at the Trump campaign after careers spanning the Navy, Goldman Sachs, and conservative media. Backed by hedge fund billionaire Robert Mercer, he had taken over Breitbart News and saw Trump as his vehicle to power. His key insight? Harness Trump's chaos to target white working-class voters in swing states. His strategy was shock and awe, dominate rather than negotiate. He and Stephen Miller assembled over 200 executive orders for the first 100 days, with immigration as the nit-plus-ultra mania of Trumpism. His principle? Just doing things, rejecting bureaucratic process entirely. Chaos wasn't a bug, it was the strategy. The January 27th immigration executive order exemplified this approach. Miller drafted it after online research, with no legal review or agency consultation, creating immediate chaos at airports and nationwide protests. When staff questioned implementing it on a Friday when airports would be busiest, Bannon replied, "That's why, so the snowflakes would show up at the airports and riot." Making liberals crazy was his goal, but this chaos would eventually consume him too. Jared Kushner and Ivanka Trump took formal White House positions despite widespread advice against it. They privately believed Ivanka would become the first female president, a notion that horrified senior advisors. Trump immediately gave Jared the Middle East portfolio, which rapidly expanded to include trade with Mexico, relations with China, criminal justice reform, and the opioid crisis. His qualification? Being married to Ivanka. Kushner's transformation from Manhattan Democrat to Trumpism acolyte stemmed from Bannon's political tutoring, resentment toward liberal elites who rejected his newspaper ambitions, the intoxicating validation of winning, and his belief he could moderate Trumpism's rougher edges. Ivanka treated her father with careful lightness, even publicly joking about his hair care routine. Despite constant negative press, she maintained a carefully constructed bubble of wealthy connections and developed an ability to compartmentalize that allowed her to thrive in elite circles while defending controversial policies. Her relationship with Trump remained fundamentally transactional. It was about protecting the family brand. Within weeks, a theory emerged. The White House was no upgrade for Trump. Unlike predecessors, awed by their elevation, his Trump Tower life already included these trappings, with better accommodations. Trump retreated to a separate bedroom from Melania, installed additional TVs, demanded a lock on his door, and established strict rules about touching his belongings, especially his toothbrush, reflecting his longtime fear of poisoning. He preferred dining in bed by 6:30, with a cheeseburger, watching three screens, and calling friends who tracked his fluctuating agitation levels. He wouldn't read memos or sit through complete meetings. Professor was pejorative. He appreciated generals' appearances, but disliked their data-heavy presentations. Policy flowed upward. Staff suggested what he might want, hoping he'd think he thought of it himself. Unable to stop talking, Trump made unguarded calls lasting 30 to 40 minutes, venting about media and staff. He'd speculate on each person's flaws. Bannon was disloyal, Priebus weak, Kushner a suck-up. While callers often shared these conversations, creating constant information flow about his ever-changing thoughts. The Russia investigation became Trump's defining crisis. The June 9, 2016 Trump Tower meeting, where Don Jr., Jared, and Manafort met Russians promising Clinton dirt, became central evidence. Bannon was astonished. The chance that Don Jr. did not walk these Jumos up to his father's office is zero. Trump repeatedly considered firing FBI Director Comey in early 2017. Jared and Ivanka, worried about investigations into family finances, pushed hardest for removal. When White House counsel Don McGahn warned that firing Comey would accelerate the investigation, Trump erupted, obsessively calling Comey a rat. Despite warnings from Priebus and Bannon about political catastrophe, Trump fired Comey on May 9, 2017. 12 days later, Deputy AG Rosenstein appointed Robert Mueller as special counsel, what Bannon called a mortal blow to the Trump presidency. Staffers scrambled for criminal defense lawyers as the investigation promised months of scrutiny and crushing legal bills. After Trump's fire and fury threats against North Korea, neo-Nazis rallied in Charlottesville. On August 12, a white supremacist drove into counter-protesters, killing Heather Heyer. Trump blamed hatred on many sides, then doubled down with blame on both sides. New Chief of Staff John Kelly confronted a stark reality. The entire senior staff had reached the same conclusion. The president likely didn't have the wherewithal to function in his job. The debate wasn't whether it was bad, but whether it was 25th Amendment bad. Bannon sealed his fate with an interview contradicting Trump's North Korea threats. By the next day, he was packing up, heading back to Breitbart. By October, not a single senior staffer remained confident the presidency could work. When Tillerson's fucking moron assessment leaked, it merely vocalized common sentiment. Muchin and Priebus called him an idiot. Cohn thought him dumb as shit. McMaster deemed him a dope. Bannon predicted equal chances of impeachment, resignation, or limping to term's end. Standing on Breitbart's steps that October morning, Bannon smiled. It's going to be wild as shit.